welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians and social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Good morning, everyone. We're glad you're here. Welcome to Malone University. We're excited about today because it's a chance to talk about international social work. And this is something that our department, our social work department here at Malone, has been really excited about and trying to do more and more with. We've had some students go abroad for senior field placement. One of those students is actually in the audience, former students, Aubrey. It was Aubrey Carpenter, and I'm always forgetting your last name now. Barnett, Aubrey Barnett, was in Uganda at the Cure Children's Hospital in Uganda. So international social work is something that we're doing more and more of here at Malone. And so I don't want to talk too much about this because we're going to kind of talk about this in the course of the presentation. But just wanted to welcome everyone, wanted to introduce the folks that are going to be involved this morning. My name is Ken Stolzfus. I'm one of the professors here in the social work department. My colleagues are Dr. Jamie Hoyt Oliver and Elizabeth Patterson. We're also very excited to have Jeff Stewart and Mike Rankin from the Immigrant Worker Project here. They're going to be talking about international social work on a local domestic level. And then we're also really pleased to have Rick Hamiet's Case with us today. Dr. Hamiet's Case is the Executive Director of the North American Association of Christians in Social Work. And there's some literature from this organization on the table. It's an organization that's partnered with us today in doing this workshop. And I think it's also going to be podcasting the workshop. So if you like it so much the first time, you think, oh, I wish I could hear that again and again, that's going to be possible. Just a couple housekeeping things. We have lots of food and drinks, and in fact, the catering service told me that they have a whole extra tray of muffins and pastries, so all that to say, eat up and eat as much as you want. Also, as far as lavatories, they are out the door to your right, my left, and just around the corner here. And finally, at the end of this time today, we're going to be having an informal lunch. So anyone that wants to stay for lunch, we're just going to go through the dining hall. You'll sort of get to relive your college student days. We're going to go through the dining hall, pick up our food, and then we've got a separate room set aside where people that are interested in talking about either international social work or just faith-based social work in general can just kind of hang out and talk. So the plan for this morning is we're going to have three presentations. Elizabeth Patterson is going to be talking about faith-based social work in Romania. Jeff and Mike are going to be talking about their work domestically with immigrant populations. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about social work in Russia, faith-based social work in Russia. And then we're going to have a panel discussion at the end, time for questions and just sort of conversation at the end. So I think that's everything. Is there anything I'm missing? Okay. Well, I'm going to turn it over then to Elizabeth, and Elizabeth's going to kind of set the stage for us. Elizabeth is our resident expert on international social work, although she's cringing. She doesn't like me to call her that. But Elizabeth's in a doctoral program right now, and her research and her work is around global social work or international social work. So she's going to kind of set the stage for us and then tell us a little bit about her specific area of interest and experience in Romania. So welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Ken. All right, well, as Ken said, I am going to talk a little bit or share a little bit sort of introductory things about international social work to set the stage for why we're talking about this subject here in Ohio. Why would we talk about it, and why is international social work important to those of us who may never work overseas in another country? For me, I did work overseas in Romania for several years, a total of 6 years before I started teaching here, and still have been involved in different ways. So I'm going to talk about that. So there's going to be some overlap between talking about Romania and some general things. So hopefully we can, if you have any questions in the middle of this, we are going to have a Q&A time at the end, but if you have any questions about anything specific during it, feel free to let us know. But since we're recording it, we're going to have to get a microphone out to you to have you answer the question so that if anyone's listening to this afterward, they know what the question is. Okay, so I wanted to start off by talking about what is international social work. international social work, sometimes we think of it as just traveling to another country for a long-term or maybe a short-term trip, but actually this one definition goes a little bit broader than that. Am I close enough to the microphone? Is that okay? Okay. Okay, so international professional action and the capacity for international action by the social work profession and its members. International action has four dimensions: internationally related domestic practice and advocacy, professional exchange, international practice, and international policy development and advocacy. So this covers a lot of different areas. It could cover us learning about international practices and programs that we want to take here, learning models that we could use here, sharing models that we have with other places, and working with people here, international peoples here within our own area that we live. And that's why we wanted to include the immigration workers as well, because we thought that that was an important part of thinking about international work today. Okay, so why do we do international social work? What's the justification for it? And this is where I want to talk a little bit about faith and thinking about my faith, because definitely when I first was interested in international social work, and actually before I was interested in international social work, I was interested in doing missions. I felt a calling to do something with missions, and social work ended up being the avenue for that. That was way back in high school and then in early college. So when we think about this, though, think about what has been the history of international work, both since we're thinking about faith-based work, I wanted to think about what has happened throughout history. So there's been good and bad things that actually, I think, have happened throughout history when we're thinking about international work. So there's been a lot of good things, you know, in terms of thinking about how even in the idea of globalization. Things have happened. There's been exchange of ideas, exchange of goods over time, but there's also been some things that have happened sort of negatively, such as the ideas of colonialization. What has happened when sort of we've incorporated our models in other countries that maybe haven't always worked in terms of thinking about our culture and imposing our cultural values on other people in certain ways. So I think these are things that are kind of important to think about when we're thinking about international work and what we do. So that's something that I'm going to talk about a little bit. But when we think about globalization and what's happening today, it has increased exponentially since the 1990s. We've always been involved in international things. Even social work has. If we think back to some of the founders of social work, like Jane Addams and Mary Richmond, they were involved in international work. And they were taking models, such as the Settlement House movement. There were models from the UK that were brought here and vice versa, and travel that they did at that point. But also, Jane Addams was very involved in the international peace movement. So international social work has been a part of our history for a long time, but when we think about international social work now, we hear a lot more about it. What is international social work? A lot of students are interested in doing international social work, and one of the reasons for that, I believe, is because of globalization and thinking about how that's affected us, and it's affected sort of what we do in our understanding of the world and the way the world has become increasingly smaller in ways. Where we're just talking about the internet and remembering when internet did not exist this morning and all this technology that we use every day in our life. I can't believe this weekend I just got a phone and I have internet on my phone, and I've never thought I would do that. It just seems sort of ridiculous, but there's reasons that we have internet. I mean, we use internet and these resources that come to us. But through technology, we're more aware of what's going on in the world in certain ways. But there's also some other things that, you know, have happened related to globalization. Think about the global market and how that's affected us. And we might think that's only an economical issue, but I believe it relates to social work in ways too in our work. So this is just some things that I wanted to think about or share with you. I think that globalization has affected social work in a very complex way. We could easily just say, we hear these sort of random statements out there, thinking about, oh, look at all the immigrants that are coming here and they're wasting our resources. They're taking resources away from Americans. Sometimes you hear things like that, where someone's looking at things one-sided, or look at all the jobs that are being taken away from us here in the U.S. to people from other countries, or things like that. I know when I was in Romania, it was a big thing to think about. Look at all the people that are leaving Romania, the brain drain. There was a lot of very active people within our church, within our programs that were offering so much to the country, but because the pay was so little for what they were doing or they couldn't find a job, they were leaving to go to other places. So I started to think about these things in a lot of ways and all the positives and negatives. So this chart just sort of looks at some of these ideas, just as some examples. So if we think about what's going on in North America, we might say that because of the effects of globalization and jobs are moving to other places, we actually might think that's a bad thing because we're losing jobs, and that is a negative thing to many people that have been affected by that. But we are gaining from the lower cost. So there's positives and negatives. So sometimes we complain about certain things, but we don't look at the benefits. Whether that's good or bad, these are just issues, you know, things to think about. And we have an increased underpaid workforce for unwanted jobs. So there's a lot of jobs that Americans actually would prefer not to have, and certainly not for the pay that we are offering to other people. So we benefit from that as well, and we have services provided for us for lower pay. So that's one way that, you know, some of the positives and negatives to globalization. But this does affect us in terms of our work as social workers and thinking about the losses of jobs within our country. Many of those people end up receiving social services in some way or another at some point in their life. It certainly has affected social services, so it's something to think about. So if we think about things going on in other places, in China, a lot of jobs have moved to China. So that, in some ways, is very positive for Chinese workers to have more job opportunities. But I don't know if you've watched any of the documentaries or heard any things, but often they're being paid extremely little for even just us buying a pair of jeans, you know, on sale or something for $20 or whatever. They're often being paid so little, maybe a couple dollars a week or something, to make many jeans with very unjust work conditions, working many hours under a lot of pressure. It's positive there's a job available that they may not have had before, but the conditions are not something that we would want to live with, certainly. But it's not a simple solution for us to say, okay, I'm not going to buy jeans bought in China. It's just a complex idea because they are happy. There's this good documentary called China Blue, if anyone's interested in hearing more about this, that thinks about some of these things. And actually, the workers and their stories, they're actually blessed to have these jobs. So if we stop buying those jeans, it just doesn't solve anything. But there's something bigger going on than this that is more complex, I believe. So, and taking it more personally to the work that I did in Eastern Europe, so they're sort of caught in the middle of all of this because there are a lot of jobs, for example, a lot of factory jobs for making clothing in Romania and other things such as ceramics, pottery, pots and pans, things like that. So a lot of people I knew worked within these factories and usually made maybe a couple hundred dollars a month. And there's a factory that made Calvin Klein. So if you buy something full price at Calvin Klein, it may cost you $100. And their salary is only twice that amount for the whole month. So, and the conditions weren't that great as well. But a lot of these factories, they were closing because the jobs were moving to other places, such as China. So they were losing jobs. And so we were, you know, sort of dealing with the effects of that, where people were not having the jobs. For example, IKEA. Are you familiar with IKEA? A lot of the pottery or plates were made for IKEA were made in Romania. And now, I actually was at IKEA a year ago or so and was seeing half of them were made in Romania, now half of them were made in China. And I remember that happening, that process, as they were saying, oh, the factory it wasn't closing, but they were laying off a bunch of people because of the jobs that they had for IKEA or the projects they had for IKEA were moving to China. And I saw that actually in reality here. So that was affecting the people that I knew, people I went to church with, some of the parents of the people that we had in our social service programs, the kids in our programs, things like that. And so, anyway, it's just all of these things that are happening it was positive, maybe, that there have been job opportunities in Romania, but negative when things were leaving. And then also, the other thing is people wanting to leave the country. This happens in the global south, such as the Hispanic countries, as well as Eastern Europe and other parts of the world. And as people are leaving other countries, they're being promised good things often. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes that puts them into situations of human trafficking, either labor trafficking or sexual trafficking, which is another issue that affects our work and social work and thinking about that. So all of this just to sort of set the stage for when we think about international issues that are happening overseas, it's a local issue, too, often. It affects the job state within our country. It affects things, social issues, social problems, such as human trafficking and the idea of, okay, a lot of the people we serve, we want them to be able to afford things. Well, they're actually able to afford things often because of jobs being moved overseas. So it's not simple. It's complex, and there's things that are happening locally that are certainly international in many ways, new immigration issues, new refugee issues, human trafficking, things like that. So I just wanted to sort of talk about that a little bit. Okay, so when we think about global social work or international social work and why we do international social work, there's some things in the code of ethics that I believe relate to that. I know what we do as social workers isn't just about reciting the code of ethics, but there's some principles within that that sometimes we don't really think about. We usually look at the first part of the code of ethics, but we don't look at the end, where it talks about our obligation to the broader society, which includes global work. So I just wanted to point that out and to think about some of the other things, social justice issues. I believe social justice goes beyond just what's going on in our own country, especially with the complexities that we think about related to globalization. The global is local, the local is global, and so what does social justice mean? And when we're in a very privileged country, it doesn't mean we don't have a lot of need within our own country, but the privileges that we have, how can we use those, and the opportunities that we've had to have a pretty great history of social work within our country. And so I believe there's a lot of amazing skills that we have in social work that we can bring and offer to the international world. And so that's part of thinking about what is our obligation as social workers when we think about international issues. Cultural competency, that's one of the things that we talk about a lot in social work. And we learn how to try to practice in a culturally sensitive or competent way. That's something that we should always offer and keep in mind when we're thinking about international issues. Self-determination and promoting dignity and worth. These are two important principles we think about in terms of our values and social work. And when we think about self-determination, I think that's something important to think about when we're practicing international social work, whether here locally or overseas, because we do have a lot of great things we can offer to other people, but they have a lot of great things they can offer to us and that we can learn from, and not thinking about, oh, well, what we have has been so great. We have this long history of social work here in our country, and not thinking about what do we need to learn from them to make this culturally appropriate in terms of practicing cultural competency in the context of the other culture that we're working with, whether here or overseas. So now I'm going to think about this as it relates to faith. So as faith-based social workers, we really have the opportunity to combine our Christian calling and Christian principles with our social work skills to empower people that have been oppressed throughout the world, as we do as social workers. So in thinking about that a little bit, I wanted to talk about that and think about what I did in Romania and tell you my story a little bit as it relates to that. So I, let me move on to, oops. Okay, there we go. I skipped a slide. Sorry about that. Okay, so when I think about that, first of all, in terms of my personal faith motivations and other people I know who have been involved in international social work, I think about the Great Commission. What does that mean? Jesus commanded us to go into all the world and to preach the gospel. Well, I believe the gospel is the message of salvation, and included in the message of salvation would be the good news to the poor, good news to the oppressed. And as social workers, especially social workers of faith that are considering how our faith fits into social work, that idea relates to doing international social work and what that means. And that certainly has been a big part of what I have done and what has motivated me and helped contribute to the calling that I have felt to international social work. the holistic gospel that goes along with what I said, that the gospel is salvation, but there's so much that we can offer, I believe, as social workers to encompass the entire gospel. And if we look at Old and New Testament passages, there's so much about reaching out to the needs of the poor, the oppressed, the widow, the orphan, the sojourner, the foreigner. And there's so much that we as social workers, I believe, have to offer to that in an international setting. Think about the incarnational model of Jesus. Jesus came to earth as a man and as an example to us. Well, when we do social work, I think we could think about what that means for us. We are not all God. We are not God. But as we move to another place, there's this concept that this man, Lingenfelter, talks about us being 150% person. It's somebody who talks about cross-cultural work. And think about that. He talks about Jesus as a 200% person. He was all God and all man. But when we cross cultures to think about how much we can gain from the other culture, because there's things that we need to learn from the other culture, but we're not going to lose all of our culture. There's something that we bring. We're being fake if we completely decide, if I was like, I'm Romanian now, I'm not American, the first 20-some years of my life, I was living in the United States. I am an American. There's something I'm bringing there. But there's something hopefully I can lose or give up as I was working in Romania and gain in a way that makes me hopefully a better person to be able to reach out and minister in a way that is more effective, which that comes from that model of Jesus of coming here to earth, becoming all God and all man. And I don't think that we can sort of live up to that fully, but there's ways that we can incorporate that in who we are as human beings. So when I first decided to get into international social work, I decided to study missions and social work in my undergraduate studies, and I got the opportunity to spend a semester in Romania. I didn't think that I was going to necessarily end up spending many, many years in Romania, like I ended up. I thought it was just going to be a great opportunity. It was the one opportunity I had to do an international social work placement. But when I went there and saw the need that was there and the opportunity to bring my skills together, I had done a lot of missions experiences and some service learning kinds of things, but that was the one opportunity when I was under the supervision of a social worker there and doing social work practice, that I couldn't believe how the two things fit together so amazingly. The idea of missions, the concepts and the theories of missions, as well as social work. And so it was just so fulfilling to me. There was also a lot of need there, definitely a lot of need that I was seeing. You can see where Romania is. It's the green country there. So it's in Eastern Europe. It's one of the countries that was not part of the Soviet Union, but was communist during that time. So around the same time that the fall of communism happened in the Soviet Union, it happened in Romania. It was December 1989. And it was during that time that it was sort of discovered all of the social problems that were in Romania. It was interesting, and Ken could probably talk about this a bit because it was very similar in Russia. There was supposedly no social problems in the country, and there were not social services to go along with the social problems because it was a perfect state. Everyone was equal. So there's no social problems if everyone's equal, right? You know, that was the justification, or what was told to people, what was said. But it was certainly revealed to the rest of the world that that wasn't the case in December and January of 1989. People were starving. There wasn't enough food to go around. Food was rationed, but you get to the front of the line with your food vouchers, and there's not necessarily bread or eggs or whatever you need. And because the Ceausescu, who was the final communist dictator, he had decided to pay off the national debt by selling much of the food supply of the country to other places, which left them without enough food to provide for the needs of the country. That was just one example. Other things that happened were there was a lot of people, well, for the same reason, really. People couldn't afford to necessarily feed their children. Some of the babies were becoming more malnourished for various reasons, but that would be one of the reasons. And so the government was encouraging people to send their kids to an orphanage where they would be able to be provided for, have the food they needed. So that was one of the reasons that there was the rise in the number of abandoned children. These orphans weren't necessarily true orphans. They had parents most of the time, but the parents weren't able to to afford to feed them, so they'd end up in an institution. And when I first went, I worked with some of these kids, and you could tell that when I would meet some of the parents every now and then, that the parents really did care for their kids most of the time. But they, and I saw this one kid that was a girl that was sent home because they were doing a lot of deinstitutionalization while I was there trying to solve the problem, because the rest of the world was reacting to this problem. Oh, and so Romania decided they had to do something to reduce the institutionalized children. So to do that, they were just sending the kids back home. And this one girl, she got to the point that she could not even lift her head. She was so malnourished. Her mom brought her into our building where we had other after-school kinds of programs for kids who were in their homes. And she was just, I don't know what to do. But it was because she couldn't afford to feed her, and she was just so malnourished. We were told when we brought her back to the hospital that she would have probably died within an hour. So that was a situation the mom brought her to us because she really cared for her but couldn't provide for her. So it was better for her to at least be somewhere where she could get more food. But there was a lot of other problems related to institutionalization as well, where the kids were not, at least the ones that we worked in, there were some good institutions, but the ones that we ended up in, often the kids were not given any attention except for the 1 or 2 hours that we were allowed in there as students. And they would only let us in, the foreigners, often not the local people. I don't really know why, but I think it was because it was kept somewhat secret that this problem was there. So anyway, that's just one example. You hear a lot about the institutions in Romania, so that's why I brought that up. But there's a lot of other things that were going on during that time besides that, but I just wanted to share that example. The general public certainly was seeing the effects of poverty, not just the poorest of the poor, but there was a particular group, the Roma or gypsy population, that we often worked with because they were considered the least advantaged. Certainly there was a lot of discrimination and prejudice against them, as well as they often didn't have the same work skills that other people had because of this cycle of discrimination. If you have to survive somehow, you probably will survive by begging and maybe even stealing if that's the only way that you can provide for your family. And so that was the case, not amongst all Roma people, but some of them. And so we were ending up trying to have social services or programs for them, especially starting with the kids and then leading to work with families as well. So the organization that I worked with in Romania is called Veritas, and it actually started as a study abroad program for students. So when I first went, I went through the Romanian studies program. And we worked with the abandoned children. We had some sort of after-school type programs in a church that we were sort of affiliated with for kids that hung out on the street, sort of like the street kids. But they usually did have a family they went to at home. Not all of them, but most of them did. And so we worked with those kinds of programs. But as things developed over time, an NGO or non-government organization, or we usually call it a nonprofit organization here in the States, was started called Veritas. And we started working with all different kinds of people, continued the programs for children, both children that were in their homes and institutionalized children. But eventually all the institutions that were in our area closed because of this deinstitutionalization that I was talking about. And so we ended up working with the kids as they went to their homes, often just back dropped off with their families if they could find their family. And sometimes that was a good situation. If they had just some support with food and clothing and things like that, they would bond very well, and we'd see amazing results and how important it is for a child to have a family. It was really neat to see what would happen in some of those situations. But there were other situations where the children did need to go into a foster home or longer-term adoption in some way. And so that's something that we worked with locally as well. But there were also another group of people, the older adults, that not many people were paying attention to. So there's been a lot of attention in Romania about the children, and we even still sometimes hear little blurbs about that. But the older adults were a group of people that were promised to have wonderful pensions during the communist time, and they were the workers during that time working very hard and with the idea they would be provided for the rest of their life. Well, when the fall of communism happened, that wasn't the case anymore, and there's still pensions, but they're very, very small, and it may cover your medication for the month, but no food, or just food and not your medication, or maybe your rent, but not food. So things started off with some home visits and some support in that way to older adults, but then that led to realizing one of their needs was just socialization as well as some of the physical needs, because a lot of them had younger children or family members that had left the area for some of the reasons that we were talking about before, whether to other countries or to bigger cities. And so that left a lot of somewhat abandoned elderly or older people. So we started one elderly club, and then that led to three. Now there's three. There were two when I was still there. Now there's a third in different parts of the community, so people could come together, have some coffee and some snacks, things like that. Some of them, there's a meal provided at least once a week, and then other meals provided at the main building we have for those that needed a meal every day, and then just the socialization needs that a lot of them had. So those were some of the programs. We had a grant through USAID, so our tax dollars at work in foreign countries, to do a domestic violence project, which was another big issue there. And certainly the awareness that domestic violence was an issue, that was the beginning of it, just to help people to become aware, but then to provide services for people who were victims of domestic violence. And that program got involved in some of the awareness of human trafficking and other forms of violence as well. So all these programs were programs that originally weren't intended to be started through the study abroad program, but in this process, there was a lot of need. There weren't a lot of people doing much in the town I lived in. Sighișoara was the name of it. It was about 5 hours from the capital city, and most people would go to Bucharest to start social services, so there wasn't a lot going on in Sighișoara. But anyway, during that time, something that was started, a social work professor went over there and was running this program, but realizing the need to start the NGO, Veritas, and in that process we ended up having, now there's currently about 25 Romanian staff, which was a pretty exciting thing to see happen. Let's see. I'll talk about that in a minute, but this is an older picture when I was still there, but this is some of the staff at a retreat. But it's been a really neat thing in terms of talking about these values that I was talking about earlier, to work with a bunch of Romanian staff to provide programs within their own country to help the local people. And it wasn't about us as foreigners going over there and doing all these wonderful things or trying to do wonderful things. We were a part of the process, but now these people and a few more are leading those programs. And it's been exciting. When I left, a Romanian took over my job, and that was my goal. That's one of the reasons that I'm back here, is because I really felt like that was an important part of the process, to have local people taking over, not just the sort of directing each individual program, which is how it was when I was there, but directing the overall thing. I'm never going to fully understand Romanian culture, and even though I tried to learn the language and did okay with the language, I still was not Romanian, and I felt like it was very important. We all felt it was very important to have Romanian leadership take over, and that really is a value of missions, a value of social work. When we think about self-determination and empowerment principles, that's something that I think we need to always keep in mind when we're thinking about work in international areas. It's been exciting to say this year, the director, Veritas, is now a Romanian as well, which was a really big step. Dorothy Tarrant, the one who started everything, she started as the professor leading the study abroad program. She also continued as the director of Veritas, but she just gave over that leadership to Petra, who was the person that had taken over my job and now is the director. So that's pretty exciting to see that happen. Dorothy's still there. She's still directing the Romanian Studies program, which still continues. When I was a student, we as students led most of the programs, and we had Romanians as translators. But now to see that process slowly happen over time and now have Romanians leading everything, but the Romanian Studies program continues on, and there's still opportunities for students to go over there and do similar things in a way, but they're not necessarily directing Kids Club. They're taking leadership responsibilities, but with the direction of Romanian staff and working in partnership with them, which is it's what I believe should be happening. There was a time and a place for the students and the volunteers to be doing that, but now it's in a place where they can do pretty amazing things and learning from the Romanians and working alongside them while they're also able to contribute things as well. And these pictures are actually some of the Malone students that went on a three-week trip a couple of years ago and got to do various things. And the student in the middle, she's actually not a social work student, but she went and spent the summer there, last summer in Romania, doing an internship, actually it was her honors thesis work, but helping to develop a new program for people with disabilities, since that was her area of interest. And it was really a neat opportunity for her. And it was something that they planned it with the goal that it could be sustainable after she left. And so that actually really, really helped them in many ways to do some things, because she raised the funds to help that program have the seed money it needed to get started, so it's something that they could continue after she left. Okay, so when we think about international work and the global and local implications, this is just sort of a summary of some of these things I think that we should think about. I mentioned many of these things before, but to reverse that process of colonialization and the mentality of that practice, and really what that comes down to is what I'm meaning is often we go places and we think this is the way it has to be, or when people come here, this is the way they have to be as they integrate within our community. But how can we think about that and go back to our roots of social work and our Christian values too, and think about what does this really mean and how can we be a part of empowering people, appreciating the diversity that they bring to the situation in a way that they can feel that their voice is heard and they can be a part of the conversation and a part of developing whatever needs to happen, whether that's at the micro level with the individual work or more at the macro scale with developing programs or policies that relate to the international issues that we come across. Practicing social justice principles, self-determination, cultural competency and sensitivity, and integrating our faith with the values and ethics of social work can really be a powerful thing, I believe, when we go back to what does that really mean and think it through rather than saying, oh, I'm going to do something, and not thinking through what that means and thinking through how do our social work values and ethics need to be incorporated into this in a way that is empowering at all levels. So I'm going to stop now, and I think we're going to move on to the local group that is going to share about some of the really neat things that they're doing in this county. So thanks.
I'll just introduce you quick. Our next speaker is Mike Stewart. Sorry. I'm confusing the names here. Jeff Stewart from the Immigrant Worker Project. And Jeff's actually the director of the Immigrant Worker Project. Is that right? So, welcome, Jeff.
Good morning. And I know I'm in a social work and Christian values conference because everybody's like in church. You're all in the back. Okay, so what we're going to do is myself and Mike Rankin, who's one of our current workers, are going to talk about the work that we do. And Mike is going to talk about some of the faith underpinnings of the work we do. But just to give you a brief history of who we are, the Immigrant Worker Project is we're a organization that works across rural Ohio. We're based, our base is here in Canton. So we're based here in Canton, but we work across all of the rural areas of Ohio. We were originally formed from a convening of the Ohio Catholic Conference. So that was our initial start, and from there we're an independent nonprofit NGO working with rural immigrants. So our charge is to work with rural immigrants across the state, people working probably 55% to 60% in agriculture. The rest are rural immigrants that are working in light industry and what we like to call near green industries. Such as some of the food processors or some of the seedling factories. Here you can see people's pesticide equipment in one of the local nurseries that we work with. A lot of the people we bring in that we work with People that are brought in either in this workplace, H-2A, agricultural workers that are brought in temporarily for 9 months out of the year, which you can extrapolate some of the problems that would occur as you're separated from your family for 9 months, brought here to work for 9 months, and then you get 3 months home with your family, and then you come back again. And we'll talk a bit about that in a few seconds. And then also workers that are here year-round, some of the dairy workers, some of the workers that migrate between here, Texas, Florida, either locally around this area or throughout the state. IWP, you see a picture of some of the poultry workers. There's a guy getting ready for work in one of the factories that does light manufacturing. Some workers out there, please. We'll stay there for a second. IWP works in five separate areas. Our five areas, or ramas, as we say in Spanish, are education and leadership training. So we have 27 ESL sites, English as a second language. We work with computers in Spanish. And we do leadership training, faith-based leadership training that we've partnered extensively with both the Mexican-American College, that used to be the Mexican-American Cultural Center, as well as ICLM, el Instituto Cultural de Liderazgo del Medio Oeste, the Intercultural Institute of the Midwest that we've worked with extensively. We also have workplace rights division that we work in, and an immigration rights project. Those are the two areas that I'm working the most in. We have an economic literacy and development program, and then access to social services. So that's where a lot of our social work is done in terms of helping people with access to hospitalization, education, helping students adapt to a new schoolroom settings, dealing with the social services bureaucracies where there's both legal barriers, such as even if you're here as a permanent resident, you have to have 10 years before you can qualify for any social services, or 40 quarters in the country. And so people don't know that. So how do you negotiate that? But there's some exceptions. For example, if you've been here for 7 years as a legal permanent resident and your wife has been here for 3 years as a legal permanent resident, you can combine those to get to your 10 years. And so there's these types of issues that come up that we play around with, as well as interpretation issues. So that issues as people go into medical settings, into social work settings, into counseling and therapy, how to not only bridge the cultural gap, which is fairly immense, but also how do you bridge the linguistic gap? So how do you effectively communicate, not just communicate with a transliteration of what's being said, but actually an understanding? And that's to a certain effect. Here you can see some of the housing for workers. That's further hindered by the fact that while the vast majority of the people we work with speak Spanish, there's a good 30% of the people that work throughout the region that may speak other languages. Up on the New York State border, we get some people that speak Creole. We also get a numerous people that are indigenous from their own home region. So we have people we have a substantial community that speak both Mam, Quiche, Ishil, all Mayan dialects. We also have Nahua. And so these are dialects that are difficult to find interpreters for in any circumstance. For example, we work in the immigration courts, and in the immigration court here, we have sometimes cases with Quiche speakers. We have to have a Quiche interpreter flowing in from either Washington, D.C. or San Francisco for those court dates. That just shows you sort of the rarity of some of the languages that people are speaking with. And, of course, as social workers, I'm sure you're already aware, there's a real need to have an independent interpreter in all of these situations. So what you try to avoid continually is having children come in and interpret for their parents, or having some friend come in. We just recently did a study of six counties to the eastern part of the state where they had friends coming in to interpret for people, and everybody in the was not using the professional interpretation that was available at the local hospital. And so instead they were using friends. And as we dug deeper, what we found out that these weren't really friends. These are what we like to call notarios or notarias. These are people who place themselves in the community and provide unauthorized practice of law, that provide rides to people, that provide interpretation. And in that process are charging people $150 to $200, which could almost be a full week's salary, to get them to the hospital and to interpret for them in the hospital, when that, under Title IV, is something that they should have access to for free. It's their right, and anybody who goes to the hospital, to have interpretation and to understand their diagnosis in their own language. And so, you know, these people are abusing the community, and they use these issues to hold sway over the community. So here you can see one of our leadership programs. That's Miriam Banham from an order down in Texas that's worked with us through ICLM. She actually just recently moved back to Mexico. She's working in some of the poorest neighborhoods in Mexico. Why were we formed, I think, talks to the issue of who's here. We were formed because parishes and churches across the state were starting to see people coming in to the local environment that they hadn't seen before, in areas they had never seen before, areas of Ohio that had never seen diversity before. Okay, well, let's not even talk about immigrants, Latino immigrants. They hadn't seen any diversity. And then all of a sudden they wake up one day and there's 50 or 150 guys from Mexico, or in the cases of some of the counties just to the south of here, 800 to 900 Guatemalans. And so you start to say, how do we deal with these problems? And that's the point that the Ohio the Ohio Catholic Conference gathered together various agencies, social groups, various denominations of faith. There was the Mennonites were there, the World Church Services, and everybody gathered together to talk about how do we address these issues and how do we create a pathway for these people to become integrated into their communities and into the services that they need, and to help them adapt and also to protect them in workplace situations that many times they're abused. And that leads us to one of our fundamental principles. Based on the faith teachings that we have through the conference, but also the other faith-based organizations that were with us, we believe in the dignity of every human being. And so, therefore, there may be people that we work with that have no documentation. There may be people that have documentation. It's not our job to enforce immigration law. It's our job to serve the people and to deal with their needs. So we're there solely to deal with anybody who comes to us and help them regardless of status. Well, why were people all of a sudden showing up in Ohio? And that's one of the key issues. And let's see if we can... Okay, here's another one of our leadership training groups. And I'm going to go over here to the computer for a second. Just please excuse me. And get back into this and pull up this. And here we go. All right. So, why were people coming in all of a sudden to Ohio? Well, you can see right here, even though this is only data up to 2002, we have had an increase in several products. One was chickens. Everybody's been eating a lot of chicken sandwiches. Because chickens production in the 10 years that you can see here up to 2002 went up astronomically. We went up from 30 billion pounds of broiler chickens produced to 45 billion. In this region alone, that meant an expansion in chicken production and expansion in the chicken plants. So for here, example, there are several chicken plants producing chickens for everything from fast food to the stores where you go shop for your chickens, and most of that labor is immigrant labor, okay? Partially because the lines move so fast. The lines are moving at 144 birds per minute, okay, at some of the fastest plants. That means, but per minute is from when a chicken comes in to it comes out wrapped like you see in the store. That's how many birds are being processed per minute in the plants. They're processing between 95, the one of the biggest plants, between 95 to 140,000 birds a day. Okay, so that expansion was one of the reasons that it went up. Well, this isn't going to work on this side. Another reason that it went up, and one of the things that most people don't realize, is Ohio is one of the major egg producers of the country. Okay, and so Ohio has expanded its eggs production, and it's actually Ohio has ranged between the top egg producer in the country to the second leading egg producer in the country for many years. So it's been vacillating back and forth. Currently between Ohio and Georgia's come up, so they're the state right next to us now in terms of egg production. So egg production became a piece. And this is another area where it's a very dirty area. There's a lot of the sluice lines and everything. And it was an area that just lent itself to immigrant labor coming in to do the work. Okay. Another piece has been dairy production. Ohio's been one of the major areas in which dairy expansion has occurred, partially because the lack of good water in California. Meanwhile, nationwide dairy production has gone up astronomically as well, but particularly in Ohio. So in Ohio, there's been a vast number of dairies, not just coming locally, but in some cases we have a multiple cultural interface, because what's going on is we have mega dairies that are bought out by Dutch ownership. And so Dutch are coming in and moving into dairy land in Ohio, and then they bring in immigrant labor to work the dairy. So we have Dutch owners with, say, Mexican workers. Okay, and so you can imagine the cross-cultural differences that are arising there and some of the problems that can arise. Okay. And then finally, the last piece that I want to talk about is the production of nursery products. You can see, if you look at the map of Ohio, you can see sort of this red, dark red right around Cleveland, Columbus, Cleveland all the way reaching down here into Stark County, Columbus, and then over into the area around Cincinnati. What we've seen is as cities expand and you get expansion of suburban development into farmland, you all of a sudden need instant nurseries. You need shrubbery, trees, and all of these things that that have been not there because it was farmland before. And as you build these big tract developments, you need that nursery industry. So the nursery industry has become a major force in Ohio. Currently, a nursery industry is producing $2.4 billion worth of GDP for Ohio annually. So it's one of the major leading industries in Ohio. And so nursery production became one of the other key pieces of production that brought labor here to Ohio. Okay. And so, well, I guess we're going to stay on the nursery map for a second until I can get that to move over. So, as the new groups came in, they also were pushed out of where they'd come. So let's talk about the push factors for a second that were pushing people here and why people are coming either legally with H-2A visas and coming across to here to stay for 9 months or an H-2B visas here sometimes for 4 years without seeing their families. As you can imagine, that's something that is extremely difficult for them and their families. And you just imagine if you were to be separated from your children, your wife, for that amount of time. Or if they're coming without documentation across the border, many times they have to be here up to 5 to 7 years before they've made enough money to be able to make a trip back home. And so what was the reason that that's happening? And that's partially because back home in Mexico and Guatemala and the rest of Central America, there's been a crash in some of the prices for foodstuffs that were produced there. So coffees crashed all the way down in, say, Veracruz to 1 peso for a cosecha of coffee for a basket, which means that the worker who's picking the coffee only gets a half a peso. So they're not making enough money to be able to live back home. or in Guatemala, the prices have skyrocketed from people who have migrated. And so if you want to build a home in Guatemala, if you want to make any type of economic advance, you have to do labor outside of your home country. You can't just do cash crop labor in, say, the indigo fields or someplace, and you're certainly not going to make a living back home on your own land just growing crops. And the rise in corn prices has meant that, and the expansion of corn exports through NAFTA and also now through CAFTA has meant that the corn producers, local corn producers in these areas have been wiped out. So as their own agriculture has been wiped out by free trade, as they have lost economic sustainability and the cost of living has gone up back home, what has happened is they're facing a trade-off with either come to the United States to work or watch my family starve. And as one gentleman told me at one point, he says, if you're sitting at the table watching your family starve and you know that you can come across the border and make enough money in one day that your family couldn't make in a month, are you going to tell me you're not going to take that choice? Or are you going to sit there and watch your kids starve? And so those are choices that people are forced to make because of some of the international trade problems that exist and some of the structures that exist at this point in time. So hold on for one second. I'm going to try one more time to get this back up, but I don't think that's, if you could help me there. Thank you. And then let's talk about who's coming. Oh, great.
Thank you.
Let's talk about who's coming. 63 to 87%, depend on the study that you're looking at, of the people that are coming are solitary males. And so this has a huge consequence, as you can see at the training here. This is one of our leadership trainings. You can see we're talking about mostly males that are attending the course. And let's go back to this. So what's happening, and I say very intentionally, solitary males, because it's not single males, although there are many single males, but they're males that are leaving family and children behind, okay? And at first, that connection is very strong, and they may call every week, and they're coming back, and they're calling back to their family members. But then, over time, those connections weaken. And as those connections weaken, they stop to have the time to speak to family members. They're working, you know, most of these people figure if you're not working 60 hours a week, you're not getting enough work. So if we go into a house somewhere, we're doing a home visit, we're talking to somebody, and you know, we say, how are things going? And they say, oh, it's terrible, it's terrible. And we say, well, why is it so bad? Oh, I'm only working 40 hours right now. You know, most of us would think, wow, 40 hours, you know, doing some heavy, heavy work, you know, where you walk away almost exhausted, where most of us wouldn't even be able to keep up with the pace. Then, you know, wouldn't that be enough? And they're going, no, can't you find me another part-time job? I want to work another 20 or 30 hours. Guys in the dairies are working between 19 to sometimes 100 hours a week in the dairy. And that's one of the reasons, too, for the dairy workers and some of the agricultural workers need to work so many hours is something that you may not know. But if you're an agricultural worker in the United States, you do not make overtime, because the fair labor and wage standard for the United States does not reach to agricultural workers. So like if you're an industrial worker and you work time and a half, you work over 40 hours, you get automatic overtime. But if you're an agricultural worker, you don't get that.
Are the folks in the chicken factories considered agricultural?
They're half agricultural and half industrial.
So they don't get overtime?
Some get it, some don't. It depends if you're you're on the half where the chicken's dead or the chicken's alive, okay? Because they do. I mean, just to think for a second. Thank you for taking me back to the poultry factories. I want you to think for a second of what the folks are doing. These people are grabbing live chickens, thousands of them, tumbling down at them under black lights so the birds think that they're still asleep. Grabbing those chickens live and hanging them live, you know, by like this motion with a 15 to 20 pound bird. All day. That's your entire day. 8-10 hours grab those birds, hang them up. And you know who the chicken catchers are, because even though they're wearing long gloves, you can see the scars up and down their arms from where they've been scarred by the chickens. So, yes, it's something that's half industrial. And just to give you an idea why in the United States agriculture workers don't get overtime, is it's something that takes us back to slavery. Because in the 1930s, when we passed the Fair Labor and Standards Act, what happened was that Roosevelt goes to pass it, and at that point, the majority of Democrats were from the South. And they said, you know, we'll vote for this law, but we're not going to vote for this law if it's going to affect our sharecroppers, because you're not going to change the relationship that we now have between our ex-slaves who are now sharecroppers for us. If you do that, if you make the Fair Labor and Standards Act for agriculture as well, we'll vote against it. So to get the law passed, they had to leave agriculture workers out. And so people are working all of these hours. Now, many of the people that are coming here are married, okay? So we've got 40% of the people here married that don't have their spouse present. We have over 60% are here who have children. And many of them are extremely young. So you can see, as they're estranged from their families, as they don't have the contact, as you can think about any long-distance relationship, but one where you do not have the ability to travel back and forth. Whether you have status or not, if you're an H-2A worker, you can't say, oh, I'm flying home for the weekend. Okay, you just can't do that. Even when you have the documentation, you can't do that because you're working sometimes a 13-day shift. So you work 13 days, one day off, and then 13 days again. And so you can't go home. This creates an incredible psychological and emotional strain that then leads to alcoholism, to abuse, to violence, and so many of the issues that you'll see as social workers that stem from these consequences of how somebody works, what their living circumstances are, and what the relationship with family is. And as social workers, obviously, something that you need to always be asking into is, how is the person's workplace environment, their home environment, how is this reaching into how they're going to be able to react to the environment around them or problems that they may be having. Many of the people that are coming up are here for the first time. So 60% of the people that are coming into Ohio right now are here for the first time. And let's talk numbers for a second. We work rurally, so we don't do surveys, but we started our work with doing a survey across rural Ohio. And at that point in time, we had been told by some people in the state of Ohio, oh, we know where all the agricultural workers are, and don't worry about it. And I said to one of the heads of one of the social service agencies for the state, I said, oh, is that right? He says, yes, I know where all these workers are. I said, okay, well, in Tuscarora County, how many agricultural workers do you have? He says, little sheet. He says, 18. I said, well, I'm working down there right now. This was over 15 years ago. I said, I'm working down there right now, and you know what? I'm working, you do consider the poultry workers agricultural? Yes, of course. And I said, well, I'm working with 980 Guatemalans, so I think you're slightly off. Okay. And so then we went out and did a study. And that's actually one of my fields besides some of the other areas that I work in. I've also got a degree in demography, so I got roped into doing the study, where we went across to all the agricultural camps, to all the places where people were hanging out, and found out what people were doing and the type of work they were doing and how they were placed across the state. And so we found that many of these people were here for the first time, and that in terms of numbers in rural Ohio, we were talking about, and this is now 10 years ago when we completed that last study, we were talking about 63,500 to 70,300. That was a statistical variance, but that's how many people were here in rural Ohio. So we're talking about now probably about somewhere around 70,000 rural immigrants across the state in the rural areas. This does include Cleveland, Toledo, Columbus, Cincinnati, where there's been vast new immigrants coming back in. One of the things that this has changed is the size of some of these operations. So now, to nowadays, like a dairy operation, if you don't have 1,000 heads, you're non-functional. You know, the days of family dairies are gone the wayside. They've gone the wayside for two reasons. One, because of the mega production, because of outside money coming in. But it's also gone the way because if you were, I don't know, has anybody here come from a farm? Any of you farm families? Okay. And you're here studying now. And many people who came from farms don't want to go back. I worked a farm for a while, and I can tell you that it's very hard work. You don't want to go back to that. And so many of the children of farmers and dairy owners are saying, no, 100-hour weeks, that's not for me. I'm going to go to university. I'm going to get a degree. I'm going to move on. And so then their parents are looking, how do we keep the farm going? And many of the ways that they have to do is reaching out to immigrant labor, to bringing people in. And so that's meant that some of the changes that we've been seeing. Let's talk about just some of the things that you'll see as social workers. And then I'm going to give it over to Mike. Okay, time wise, thank you. One thing, as people are here, one of their main concerns is, as we've talked about, is to send money home. Okay, so people are sending, on average, by the studies that we've done, between $400 to $600 a month home. Out of maybe after taxes, and let me, that's a very important point, after taxes. Okay, because the one of the huge myths is that the immigrant workers here, they're coming here, whether they be with an H-2A program or whether they be with people that have no status, are not paying taxes. That's not true. Barely 5% of the people that are in the country without status are working to not pay taxes. The vast majority are paying their FICA taxes, so they're paying monies into all of the federal programs in terms of that, and monies they'll never see. Even if they're here with status, they're not going to see Social Security. They're not eligible to collect Social Security. And that's created a whole, there's a whole fund that is replenished each year of monies that come in that will never be paid out, and that the Social Security Administration is forced by law to put into a separate fund called the suspense file. And in 2004, that suspense file from immigrant workers that would not be taking monies out, both documented and undocumented, was at $2.4 billion. That was money that they basically are paying in Social Security that goes into our system that we get to use, but that they don't take out. After taxes, they're talking about maybe $1,000 take home, and that some people are sending $600 home. That means that people are going to try to minimize their costs of living here to the greatest extent possible. What does that mean? Means that you're going to have sometimes 7, sometimes 17 people living together. Okay, and sometimes 7 people living in a 2-bedroom apartment. Many times you'll have individuals who are on their own living with a family in one room of an apartment. And so there's a family of maybe 3 or 4 people living in one room, and then several other apartments with individual solitary males living. This creates whole sorts of issues in terms of issues of just the crowding, creating issues of violence and domestic violence. It creates issues of possible other domestic violence issues or sexual crimes that can occur because of the varied living circumstances. So those things are creating issues that you're going to see in your work. Some of the other issues that are created as we talked about before, the issues of alcoholism, issues of just isolation, depression, okay, and also not having, and one of the things, the key things too, is how people talk about those issues. So in other words, you're going cross-culturally. So you're looking at where something, we were just talking about this the other night with some of my colleagues from across the country. And here in Ohio, when we did a survey, the third most often disease that people talked about themselves having is susto. Okay, susto means fright. Okay. It's not a disease, obviously, but it's a psychomatic, it's a psychosomatic symptom of what people feel is the disease. So that was one of the major causes. So think of trying to explain to people about how you feel and how you're feeling and what's wrong with you. You know, is one of my colleagues from Mississippi who I was just with this weekend. We had a national gathering, and she was saying, "Yeah, I had this gentleman, and he collapsed at work." Okay, and so we took him to the doctor, and we tried to say, "What happened?" You know, and he didn't have a word for I had a seizure. He didn't have a word for that I had a fit. Okay? And so his explanation was, death left me. My life left me. I died, and then I came back. You know? And how do you explain that to a doctor? You know? And so these are some of the issues that we encounter in our work of things that are occurring. And then we talked before about the issue of interpretation. I mean, that's a key issue of giving people access to the services they need. We've had problems with interpretation and the errors interpretation, creating havoc for us with birth certificates. Because people not understanding the Spanish naming system, because in Latin America, you'll have your name, and most people do not have a middle name. But then you have your paternal father's name, and then you have your maternal mother's name. And so what the hospital will do is put maybe the paternal father's name, which really should be the surname, okay, as the middle name, and it's messing the birth certificates up. And right now we have 23 birth certificates we're preparing just from local hospitals. So these are the types of things that occur in some ways. And then the other issues are isolation because of language. And so we try to alleviate that through our English as a Second Language programs. But you can't understand how hard it is until you've lived in another country to what it means to live in another country, because you it's not just that you can't communicate. It's you can't participate. You know, one of the guys said to me one time, he said, the thing I miss most is understanding laughter. Because he said, when I was on a bus, and I was going from this place to the other place, and one of the people in the bus said something, and somebody, you know, said something else. Obviously, they were joking, and everybody in the bus starts laughing. And I'm just sitting there. What are they laughing about? Why are they laughing? You know? So there's that issue of just basic, you know, human elements of what makes us human, you can't participate in until you gain a foothold language. And don't believe, though, the myth is that people who are coming here don't want to learn English. Every single survey we've conducted, learning English is the top piece of what people say they want to do. But just like the old wave of immigrants that came, okay, the issue is time. So for us, many, we talk and we say, yes, but my grandparents learned. Yes, many of the grandparents learned after retiring from work, you know, through years and years of being here, because at the first stages, okay, people didn't learn the language because you're working 50, 60, 70 hours. Maybe you learn the language when you get a better job and you can only have to work 40 hours, you know. Maybe you learn the language when your kids get here and so you're learning through your children. You know, so there's an acculturation, but don't believe the myth that people don't want to learn the language. They do. It's consistent in any type of survey we've done and we've seen from other people that people want to learn English. It's an issue of time, access, workplace, and having an environment where they're going to be hearing English all the time. One of the other major issues that we have is, and I think I'm going to end here and then and switch over to Mike. One of the other major issues that we have is workplace injuries. So this is key. If you look at any survey, Hispanics and immigrants in particular, any type of immigrants from anywhere, have the highest injury rate at the workplace in the nation. This stems from two issues. It stems from the issue, again, of language, but the majority of it stems from that immigrant laborers are doing some of the most dangerous jobs that exist. First of all, agriculture itself is the second highest injury rate only to mine workers, and so that in itself is one of the issues that occurs. And then one of the other pieces is that, you know, a lot of injuries are occurring because people know, owners know, that they can abuse the workers that they're working with them. So they'll put them in positions. And we just had some injuries with a roofing company. You know, he had seven guys fall in 1 year, including a guy that laid unconscious for 8 minutes. Okay? What do they do with the unconscious guy after he woke up? They put him in a truck, waited till the shift was over, then drove him to a hospital. Okay? And so, I mean, there's these type of horrific injuries, and as social workers, you'll be dealing with that because you're going to be dealing with some of the consequences of these horrific injuries. I remember one of the gentlemen that we had been working with, and he had had an accident that took all of the fingers in his hand, just ripped them right off. And the first thing in the hospital he said to me was, I can't work any longer. Jeff, please just tell him to kill me. Because I can't work. What's I have no worth in life if I can't work. And so those are some of those injuries and dealing with those injuries and how you get people from A to Z and being able to come back is another key piece that you'll be dealing with social workers. I guess my last word before I hand it over to Mike is just that the work we do is really something that is joyous. So as much as I've told you about all of the social ills and the problems, working with the people we work with is one of the great joys of my life, and that's why it is a vocation and it's not work, you know, and that's why it is a calling. And that's why many times you'll find that coming from faith is going to be one of the best first steps to being a very holistic social worker. So thank you for your attention.
Good morning. My name is Mike Rankin, and I'm going to talk a little bit about my personal experiences with the Immigrant Worker Project and kind of, as a budding social servant of this community, how I see my own faith and how I see the experiences that I've seen here with these people in our community as helping me out, showing my vocation, and talking about what our topic is for today. First, I'll talk about myself a little bit. I graduated the College of Worcester in Wayne County, just next door, last May, and I've been working with Jeff Stewart for probably about coming on 2 years now. I graduated college with a degree in religious studies and political science, and for a thesis that I had to write at the end of the year, or at the end of my 4 years, I examined how transnational faith networks and faith communities are built between small communities in Wayne County and small communities in Mexico. So you actually have people praying over the phone. You actually have people sending back money to build churches and to build social services back in their communities without any help from the government, without any help from, you could say, mainline churches or large church organizations, just purely person-to-person grassroots kind of development in those ways. And that's where I'm interested in most, and that's where I see kind of myself fitting into the project most. I went to school in Wayne County, which is the dairy capital of Ohio, I'm proud to say, and there's a lot of dairy farms, a lot of very small-scale dairy farms still, and very large-scale dairy farms. So I could, a lot of my work starting out was interpretation translation services for medical or legal appointments, and we'd be driving out to some county road 215, which is a trailer next to a dairy where there's, you know, four Guatemalan guys who live by themselves, completely surrounded by nothingness except for cows and fields. So there are very strong social issues that go on here in being separated from the community, not only culturally, not only lingually, but also just in space-wise, and, you know, and not seeing people and not seeing people who you can communicate with or commune with in general. So for me personally, seeing this cross-cultural, having these cross-cultural interactions, talking to these people, hanging out with these people, and serving these people has greatly influenced me in how I see the world and how I view myself occasionally fitting into the world. This has definitely been a basis for my personal faith development, and I want to go over a few points and things that I've studied academically and you could say theologically in college to also my personal experiences. You know, I've read many books, I've read many theologians for my thesis and in my studies, but those pale into comparison than when I drive to a medical appointment with a guy from Guatemala who barely speaks Spanish, and he just blew my mind about something about Christ's nature. And I'm like, whoa. So let's go over a few points. As Jeff discussed, you know, the basis of the heart of our work is the dignity of an individual, the respect and the dignity of an individual. You know, these come from numerous verses and quotations in the Bible and in other church literature that abound in this. In Deuteronomy, it was spoken of God that the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality, He defends the cause for the fatherless and the widow and loves the alien, giving him food and clothing. And you are to love those who are aliens, for yourself were aliens in Egypt. As followers of God, as God's people, we have an intimate history of being displaced people, of being the outcast, of being the person at the lowest rung of society. And to my understanding, in looking at the Bible as a social document, as a historical document, it is a relationship between a God and the people who he loves, who are those people, who are the lowest of the low. And that gives me a religious fervor and a religious charge, but also a social charge and an action charge to go out there and fight for these people, represent these people, and integrate my life and integrate these people's lives into our broader community and try to uplift them in these ways. Also, of course, you know, Christ in his own teachings say so much, and the teachings following his, the letters of Paul abound with comparing all people as, you know, unifying all people as God's people. It does not matter if you're circumcised. It does not matter if you're a barbarian, a Scythian, you know, depending whatever social group that was the lowest of the low, a leper, a widow, an orphan, you know, all of these groups at the time the Bible was written were the lowest of the social groups. So to my understanding, it is a duty and a charge of a Christian is to see in your present day situation what is low, what has no power in the community, what has no voice in the community, and what has no ability to integrate and to advance in the rest of the community. And to me, and here in Ohio, I encountered this work while in college, and I, you know, encountered it simply just through seeing these people and seeing that, wow, they have, you know, you go to court with them and they have no understanding lingually, culturally, or legally of what's going on. And if myself as an educated individual can help them out, and as someone who can speak Spanish can help them out in those ways, that speaks volumes about where they could be going in the future. So that's kind of where I come from personally. That's how I see myself fitting into this puzzle. Currently, I'm with Jeff for another year, and maybe longer, we'll see. I do a lot of interpretation, a lot of translation services for medical appointments. I do a lot of leadership trainings, teach ESL classes, talk about the knowledge of rights, and so people understand what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do, what the police will do in certain situations and what the courts will do in certain situations if they have to encounter these. But still, I want to say that the basis of my job is to be someone in the community, someone in the Anglo community, you can say, or the white community of Ohio, that will sit down and listen to them. People are amazed. Like, wait, I was talking to a guy the other day. He was like, wait, where were you born? Are you American? I'm like, yeah, I'm born here. I'm a citizen of the United States. He's like, where are your families from? I'm like, well, they're from a different state, but they're from the United States. He goes, but how do you speak Spanish? I'm like, you know, I don't know, but it's just people are mind blown. There are these notarios, as Jeff discussed, or sometimes girlfriends, or people who try to take advantage of the community who learn Spanish. But to have a friend, to have a associate, to have someone fighting for them who is from the community they don't quite understand, they don't quite have any integration into, is a powerful experience. So it has been a powerful experience for me and a powerful experience for them. So I am glad that we've been able to talk about how the importance of cross-culturalism is in social work. It is highly important. If you're a social worker, most of the time I would imagine you're going to be working with someone that's outside of your community, outside of your personal comfort level, or you're going to be experiencing either on the side of your, let's say, client or the side of, let's say, the bureaucracy that you're going against, there's going to be a disconnect, and you're going to be the link between those two things. That's where I see myself in this job, this vocation that I've chosen. So understanding both sides of those links and trying to commune with these and trying to be that direct access is great. It's really fun, and I love it. So I think we're going to go to Ken, and thank you.
I'm going last for a reason. You know, Elizabeth spent 5 years in Romania and is sort of an expert on international social work. And Jeff and Mike have really been heavily involved for years and years with working with immigrant populations here in Ohio. My experience in Russia is very different. I spent 5 months there, And I sort of got there, I don't want to say by accident, but I'm not a specialist in Russia or in Russian culture or even Russian social work. But here's what happened. There's a program called the Fulbright Scholars Program, which sends U.S. professors and also other professionals overseas and also brings people from other countries here to America. And the idea is that education, learning, research can be tools for peace. And so that by going and learning together with people from another culture, that we're going to be less likely to hate each other, to fight each other. And so it's really a pretty neat program that our government every year spends a good amount of money doing these exchanges. So I had a friend here at Malone, Dr. Jim Brownlee, who's an English professor, who went and taught in Moscow for a year. He taught at a school called the Russian-American Christian University. And he came back and he said, Ken, you should really check this place out because the students there have to speak English, which is important because I speak very little Russian, and even less then. I didn't know a word of Russian. Niet. Everyone knows Niet, right? And they have an American-style social work program there that was actually started by Americans. So I thought, yeah, great. I'll go teach at RACU, Russian-American Christian University. Well, what happened, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this in a minute, so I'm kind of setting the stage here. What happened in the meantime, I applied for this this Fulbright scholarship and got it. And about the time I got it, RACU said, hey, that's great, congratulations, but we lost our accreditation. So now I've got a grant to go teach and do research in Russia, and I've got no place to go because this school, this Christian school in Moscow that I was going to teach at has lost our accreditation. So there were a couple days where we thought we might be going to Siberia. The Fulbright office, I'm not making this up, the Fulbright office said, we'll find another place for you. How do you feel about Novosibirsk? And, you know, of course, my wife and I went and Googled Novosibirsk, and it's in Siberia, where the temperature sometimes gets down to negative 40. The interesting thing about negative 40 is it's the same in Fahrenheit and Celsius. That's about the only good thing I can say about negative 40. It's the one point where the scales intersect. So at the last minute, it was sort of between Novosibirsk and Siberia and another city, Saratov. And that ended up being the city that we went to. And Saratov was in southern Russia, so it was not in Siberia, southern European Russia. But it still got pretty cold, but it wasn't negative 40, so we were sort of happy to be there. But so my whole, everything that I even thought I knew about where I was going kind of changed. And so I say all that for a couple reasons. One, there was a political context that led to RACU losing their accreditation, and I'm going, and it gets to church-state relationships, and especially the relationship between the state and the Protestant churches, and that's going to come up a bit later in the presentation. But I thought I'd kind of mention that so you understood how I got to Russia and where I was at. So the city we were in, Saratov, was a city of just under 1 million people, and I was teaching social work at the technical university there. Social work in Russia, as Elizabeth sort of alluded to in Romania. Social work in Russia started in the early 90s when communism ended, and all of a sudden Russia had to admit, oh, we do have social problems that we said we didn't have under communism. And so the social work education programs, when they developed, got stuck in kind of random universities. So some were in medical universities, some were in the classical universities, which are sort of like our liberal arts schools here. But the one I was in actually got put in a technical university. So this is an interesting place to be because everyone else in the university was an engineer, pretty much, except for the social workers. There was traffic systems engineering and some sort of other kinds of mechanical engineering, electrical engineering. And then the social work program was in the social systems engineering or social systems management program. So it was an interesting place to be. Some of our friends in Saratov said, you know, you really understand more about Russian life living in a city like this out in the provinces than you would have living in Moscow where RACU was. So, and also in terms, I think, of social services, we got to see some different things. So I'm going to share a little bit about what I learned about social work and especially faith-based social work in Russia. And at the end, the last slide or two, I tried to kind of distill down some things I feel like I brought back to the States with me that maybe would be helpful to some of us here. So I started off with a picture of St. Basil's Cathedral, which is on Red Square in Moscow. And when we got back from Russia, people were asking my 8-year-old son, what did you like most about Russia? And he said, people, pastries, and churches. So I thought that was pretty good if he came away with those three things. I don't have any pastry for you today. It was really good, though. But I am going to talk about people and churches. So this is one of the churches in Russia. I thought I'd start with that. But a little bit of background, since we're talking about faith and social work and the connections there between those two in Russia, I thought a little bit of kind of background would be good. So One of the things that happened in terms of the historical religious context in Russia was this, that during prior to communism, Russia was a very Christian country, and they were specifically Russian Orthodox, or I'm going to refer to the ROC, the Russian Orthodox Church. So until the communist revolution in 1917, almost everyone belonged to the Russian Orthodox Church, and so a very traditionally Christian country. All of a sudden, during the communist revolution, the Marxist idea that religion is an opiate of the masses, that religion is a way of keeping workers down and keeping people from being free, all of a sudden, this is the party line. And so we saw the Russian Orthodox Church, which had been very powerful, was very closely linked to the government before communism, all of a sudden the church is being persecuted by the communists. And so so the ROC was being persecuted. But one of the interesting things that happened and is still causing some conflict today is that some of the leaders, especially high-up people in the Orthodox Church, collaborated with the communist government. And there's been kind of some fallout from that. And people have said, well, how could you, as a Christian church, support the kinds of things that people like Stalin were doing, right, where millions of people were murdered and there were these purges? And the church has said, you know, we realize now that it was the wrong thing to do, but we were afraid we wouldn't survive if we didn't do this. And so there are sad stories about church leaders, bishops, and priests who were actually informers for the KGB and who were turning people in. There's still some anger about this in Russia. You know, how could the church have been involved in this? But since the communist, since the fall of communism, since the Soviet Union dissolved in the early 1990s, there's been what's been called a Christian resurgence or a Christian revival in Russia, where many people have gone back to the Russian Orthodox Church, and so many people who maybe weren't active during communism have gone back. But there's also still a number of people, and I met some of them, who were firmly convinced by sort of the Marxist atheist line that, you know, religion is harmful and religion is a way of keeping people down. And so there's a lot of people that didn't go back, too. But there's been this resurgence, and Russian Orthodox Church membership is really back up again, very high. So in the midst of this, there have also been Protestant groups and other religious groups in Russia. And these groups were also persecuted under communism. Those of us who are maybe in mid-30s and older may have grown up hearing stories about the churches in Russia and about people breaking in and sort of dragging people off. And, you know, as much as I'm concerned about the way that our country demonized communism and demonized Russia and the Soviet Union, there is truth to these stories. There were people that were dragged away and killed even for their faith. And I would argue, too, or I would point out, rather, that these people were both in the Protestant and in the Orthodox churches. So it wasn't just Protestants. Sometimes in this country, Protestants told the story as though it was just the Protestant church that was being persecuted, and that's really not true. But it's also true to say that the Protestants were heavily persecuted, and because they were already seen as sort of interlopers and outsiders in Russian culture, I suspect that they received even kind of heavier dosages of persecution. And so some interesting things happened right about the time that communism was falling. One thing that happened is all of a sudden, into this power vacuum, the Russian Orthodox Church reemerged as a central power, and a power that to this day has a lot of say in government. It's closely connected to the government. So very different from America, where we have these ideas of the separation of church and state. In Russia, nobody freaks out if the Russian Orthodox Church is proposing certain laws, is the recipient of certain tax benefits that other groups don't have. There really is kind of the idea that the Russian Orthodox Church is our church, and it should have some power, it should have some say. The other thing that happened, though, in the early 90s that sort of changed is that Protestant groups and other outside religious groups for a while during the 1990s were being welcomed in. And so if you talk to people, especially American Protestant missionaries in Russia now or people who were there during the 90s, they'll talk about the 90s as this wild time where anybody could come in and kind of do anything, because they're really, it was sort of a wide-open sort of country. The country was trying to figure out who they were going to be. The government was kind of reestablishing itself as a free market economy, and the church was reemerging. And so, really, Protestant Western religious groups went in and did a lot of interesting things without a lot of oversight. And there was a new openness to the government to outside religious groups, Western religious groups coming in. So the school that I was supposed to teach at originally, Russian-American Christian University, RAKU, they were actually invited to come in by the Russian government in the 90s. A Russian a group of people from the Russian Ministry of Education came to the U.S. and saw some schools like Malone. I don't think they came to Malone, but I think they went to Calvin, Wheaton, some of the small Christian liberal arts schools. And they said, this is great. Can we have one of these in Moscow? And so the schools, a number of American Christian universities got together and started the school in Moscow. And this is sort of a big deal because this would never happen today. And in fact, I think now the government is trying to think, how do we get rid of this school? And how do we get these Western Protestants out of here? Because we're really not fond of them. We don't like what they're doing. So the context has sort of changed over the last 10 or 15 years. So a little bit about kind of the current context. And I already hinted at this a bit. But one of the things that's happened is that there's hostility between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Protestant churches. And the Russian Orthodox Church has used their influence to restrict the activities of Protestant groups. So, for instance, there was a law passed at one point saying that if you want to start a church in Russia, you really can't. Any Protestant churches have to have been in existence for 10 years or longer. So now the only way to start a new church in Russia is to kind of go under the umbrella of an established church. So you'll see churches that kind of exist as umbrella corporations, and new churches can kind of come in and say that they're a part of this new or this old church, but really they're kind of doing their own thing. And so it's kind of a way of beating the system. Or you'll hear about unregistered churches, churches that are meeting in someone's house, but they really don't have government registration, and they're really not supposed to be meeting. So I will get to the social service part in a minute here, but I wanted to kind of give you some context for what's happening in the church and then also in the social work world before I bring the two together. One of the interesting things about being in Russia and being there openly as a Christian from a Christian school is in talking to my Russian Orthodox friends and my Protestant friends, I was often uncomfortable with kind of the animosity between these two groups. And it would go to the point where the Protestant people I know would say, oh, those Orthodox churches, they're not even Christian. All they do is they pray to saints' bones. And, you know, you tell them that you've got a social problem, they'll bring in the bones of saint somebody, and you'll pray over them, and that's sort of all that happens. And then you talk to the Russian Orthodox people, and they'll kind of say, these Western Protestant groups, they're interlopers. They're not really a part of our culture. And they've come in and just sort of forced themselves on us, and they've deceived people. And so you'll hear, now I didn't speak Russian well enough to understand this, but I had heard many stories about this, you'll hear radio public service announcements saying there's a Protestant church, often the term Baptist is used kind of generically for Protestant. There's a Baptist church meeting and they're a cult. They sacrifice animals, they do all kinds of crazy things. And so there's this propaganda campaign against the Protestant groups in Russia. But at the same time, the Protestant groups kind of give it back to the Russian Orthodox Church. And so it's really kind of sad because there's a big divide there. And the other thing that's really sad is both sides don't really have a history of listening very well to each other. And so, you know, one of my Protestant friends was telling me about being at a conference where the Russian Orthodox Church was leading it, and they'd allowed the Protestants to come, but then they pointed out the group of Protestants sitting near the front and said, these are some of the most deceived people in our region, and they think they're going to heaven and they're not. You know, I mean, it was kind of that blatant. And so there's just this really this really difficult context in which to work religiously. So a little bit about social work, and we'll sort of bring the two together. Social work, the professional social work, didn't exist in Russia until the early 90s. And then what happened was that all of a sudden, they said, oh, we've got big social problems. There's not enough food. There's a huge alcoholism problem. We've got, as Elizabeth mentioned, Romania, we've got people in orphanages and institutions and not enough people caring for them. And so really, anyone who sort of cared about people and had a good heart could become a social worker. And even in higher education, you know, in America, we're so funny about people having advanced degrees in their area. There's stories in Russia about people who taught, you know, English language, and they had a good heart, so they became the social work professor with kind of no more background or experience than just that they were a nice person. So very different than kind of the context here. So many of these people that sort of became social workers 15, 20 years ago, not even 20 years ago, are still working in social work today. And as the field is professionalized a bit more, as there's kind of more people coming out of universities with social work degrees, they often have a hard time finding jobs because there's the kind of the original social workers who are still in these positions. Even though often they don't really kind of understand the role of social work very well. And so I witnessed a big social work fight at my university. You don't see social work fights very often, but this was one. The social workers had this conference, and they invited their field placement staff workers in, so people where their students do field. And one of these workers was talking about using social workers to go out and buy bread for orphans, and that was kind of all they could do with a social work student. And one of the professors from another university just went off, and I was getting a little tense. I didn't know if we were going to have to separate them. But, you know, it kind of, you know, Russians are very blunt, and one of the things that I learned, I kind of appreciated it. I'll never forget, sorry, this is a side story about Russian kind of bluntness and straightforwardness. I was standing talking to the department chair of the social work program, and the dean came by, so her boss came by, and very politely greeted me, asked how I was doing in English, and then he asked the department chair in English how she was doing, and she said, "I'm very bad because of your stupid role." And he just sort of smiled, and she smiled, and they walked away. But, you know, here you'd never say that, but in Russia, they're very straightforward. So I saw this very straightforward exchange between these two, a social work professor and somebody who was a director at a field site, kind of saying social workers are just good to go out and buy bread for orphans. So, you know, there's still kind of some conflict about how social work plays out, what social workers should be doing. The other thing that you run into with social work in Russia is that the wages are really low. So I've got a picture of 5 1,000 ruble notes, and each of those is worth about $30. And this is a monthly salary for a social worker in Russia. So about $150 a month, give or take, or 5,000 rubles. 5,000 rubles sounds a lot better, but, you know, when you convert it, it's not really that good. My kids thought they were rich. Oh, we've got 1,000 rubles. Wow. Okay, but, you know, not really as good as it sounds. So one of the things that happens is a lot of people don't want to go into social work. Even people that perhaps have a heart for helping other people don't want to go into social work. And one of the things I was doing in Russia was some research on why Russian students do study social work. And what I found, just kind of preliminary findings from looking over the surveys, is that many of the people either studied social work because they came out of the child welfare system themselves. That was a small group, but a pretty steady group across two different places. Another group said, we think that social work is going to help us get a job. It was sort of like a liberal arts sort of degree. We learn about people. We learn about culture. For instance, one young man I talked to was studying to be a translator, and he kind of thought, I'm understanding about culture from social work. What I really want to do is be a translator. And then there were a group of students who got the most money by studying social work. They were maybe not, they have standardized tests to get into majors, and they didn't do well on some of the other majors. Social work, because it's trying to attract students, has easier tests, and so these people did better on the tests, and they received financial government assistance to go into social work. So very different from the U.S., where often we have this very dedicated group of people that want to help people. The professional social work, or the students who are training to be professional social workers in Russia, don't necessarily fall into it. There's often some other external reason for going into social work. And then finally, one of the other things that was interesting to me is that in America, we focus a lot on field education, on practice classes, on teaching people how to work with other people. In Russia, it wasn't uncommon for social work students to not have any field placement, not have any internships at all, and to learn really theory and research. And so even kind of the social work practice skills really aren't taught very much. So a very different profession. It almost is more policy analysis and social research than anything else. Okay, so finally, I'm kind of at the point where we're linking into the theme of the presentation a bit more. The faith-based social services in Russia. So one of the neat things that happened is despite this divide between the Protestants and the Orthodox Church, social services is one place where some groups have come together to kind of bridge that divide. And so I was reading an article by Caldwell, who's a professor in California who's done some study of religious social services in Russia. And she said, you know, 10 years ago, kind of before the early to mid-2000s even, it was very common for the various churches to kind of parcel out social services. So maybe the Protestants did the drug rehab in a city, and the Orthodox were feeding people who were starving and homeless. And what she's seen happen over the last 5 to 10 years is that these groups have started to work together on their efforts. So one of the neat things that happened, although I didn't see a lot of this, but I've kind of read about it, is that some of these church groups who really can hardly be in the same room together in other contexts are coming together to help people who need help. And that's pretty exciting that, you know, what we do is kind of becoming a ground for reconciliation in Russia. Another thing is that because the Protestant groups are often so discriminated against, social services have become a way for churches to grow. And so many of the churches that I got to know, many of the church leaders I talked to in the Protestant circles, they would say things like, the majority of our pastors are people who are recovering drug addicts or former drug addicts. They don't think about recovery quite the same way as we do here. And so they'd say they're people who were formerly drug addicts who were set free. And some of these people haven't been out of using heroin or out of being active alcoholics for very long before they're leading churches. And so it becomes a way for these churches who have a hard time recruiting because people think they're cults. You know, no one wants to go to the animal sacrifices. But if you're somebody that's living on the street, you'll go to this church because they'll help you. And all of a sudden you become a member and you get your life straightened out a bit and maybe you get your addiction under control and all of a sudden you're a valuable member of this church. So another thing that's happening there is that churches are using social service programs as a way to grow their membership. Some common things that I saw churches doing or that I've read about churches doing in Russia, one was substance abuse rehabilitation. And this is my field. This is what I worked in before I taught here. And this is what the focus of a lot of my research in Russia was on. And so I'm going to focus on that for most of the rest of the presentation. But a couple other things that churches are doing, homeless services. There are a lot of programs for homeless people. And unfortunately, there's a lot of homeless people in Russia. In Russia, the average salary is something like $12,000 a year. So a very poor country. Some of my students would say, you know, Ken, we visited America and there's a large middle class here. There's 5% who are very wealthy. And the rest of us, even people with college education, even people with advanced degrees, often are living in poverty. So, you know, I was talking to one student, somebody that I got close with, and he would take my family and I hiking. We'd be out hiking through the hills and he'd be telling me stories. And he was saying, Ken, my whole family's educated. This is someone who was in a master's degree program for engineering and was planning on going on to a doctorate. He said, I really sort of have no hope of ever making much money. So that's the situation of the educated group of people. You know, there's many people that kind of don't have enough just to get by, and so people do end up homeless. Also, it's not at all uncommon for a family of 5, 6, 7 people, you know, an extended family to live in a small one-bedroom apartment. So the people who aren't homeless are often living in very difficult circumstances. The American missionary that I mentioned, he's actually from Columbus. His name's Todd. He's been in Russia 13 years, married a Russian woman, and they have 3 children together. And their whole family lives in a one-bedroom apartment. Their daughter is now about 12 years old, and they've given her the one-bedroom just because she needs kind of some private space as she's growing and maturing. So then the husband and wife and the 2 boys sleep in the living room. They have a small bed behind the sofa, and then the boys actually sleep on the sofa and chair. And this is a family that's better off than most because, you know, they have fundraising going on in the States. So very difficult life and a lot of homeless people. There's also a lot of marriage ministry going on. And what's happening in Russia is that there's a very high divorce rate. And in fact, this is a little bit hard to explain. Let me see if I can explain it to you the way that was explained to me. One of the professors I worked with said that sometimes the divorce rate is actually over 100%. When you think about the number of people that get married and then divorced and then remarried and then divorced again, you can actually have, you know, by certain ways of measuring it, you can have more divorces than marriages in a year. And so, you know, that's what she was referring to. So it's not that every marriage fails. That would, you know, be another way of thinking about 100%. But that many years in Russia, there are more divorces than there are marriages just because of some of the demographics. So a lot of marriage ministry going on. Child welfare, and Elizabeth sort of alluded to this in Romania, and it's very similar in Russia where there's a lot of institutionalized children, and the whole idea of child abuse is kind of still emerging there as it did here in the 70s and 80s. And then finally, a lot of churches are doing work with unwed mothers. This was very interesting to me. At the university, I taught a course on American culture and society. They didn't really want me to teach about social work. They were actually afraid that the government would deport me as an illegal immigrant worker if I taught a class for academic credit. So what I did was gave a series of lectures on American culture and society. And one of the things I wanted to talk about was teen pregnancy. And when we were discussing this, we watched the movie Juno in class, and then we discussed this. And one of the things that came out is that in Russia, still, if you become pregnant as a teenager, you're forced to drop out of school. You'd never be allowed to finish school. And your life trajectory, your ability to get an education, to fend for yourself, really takes a nosedive. And so there's a lot of churches that are reaching out to people in those situations. I wanted to talk about substance abuse because, one, this is what I know the most about, and, two, it's really a serious problem in Russia. And the statistics on this are just staggering. In Russia, 30% of all deaths are related to alcohol use in some way, compared to 4% in the European Union. So a huge, you know, a huge problem with alcohol use and abuse. Among men, it's especially scary. Male life expectancy in Russia is 59 years, compared to 74 in the rest of the European Union. And I think in America, it's somewhere between 74 and 76. So a 15 to 20-year age difference, and that's linked primarily to alcohol use and also tobacco use. One of the ways that researchers measure the extent of alcohol use is how many liters of ethanol, which is the chemical in alcohol, would be consumed by each person per year. And Russia, it comes out to 18 liters, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in most countries, in most developed European and American countries, you're looking at more like 8 or 9. So Russia is almost double the per capita consumption. There's also problems with other substances in Russia. You know, Russia kind of has this stereotype of being a country with a lot of alcohol use, and as I've just said, that's certainly true. One of the things that people may not know as much about Russia is that heroin is also a huge problem. And in fact, just in the last year, Russia has become the leading user or consumer of heroin in the world. So Russia has a huge heroin problem. Part of the problem is its location close to Afghanistan, where a lot of because of some of the conflict there, there's been a lack of oversight. Many people have kind of turned to opium production there to make a living, and that's easily transported into Russia. So alcohol is a problem, but heroin is equally a problem. One of the other things that came up is there's really a need for further research as well on the other substances. We're starting to know some about alcohol use, but even there's not great research. A lot of times in Russia, people have just been kind of trying to keep their heads above water. And so there's a few people studying kind of substance abuse and addiction, but not nearly the amount of research as we have here. You know, if we want to know, I can tell you just from my research that 24% of all college students in America have a problem with drinking or drug use. You know, we don't have that kind of data in Russia. It's just not kind of out there. Just a little bit more about the situation of Russian men in terms of substance abuse. One study that was done, one of the few studies I found, found the following. They found that over the past year, 80% of males in Russia had drank alcohol. 8% had drank non-beverage alcohol, and this is a little scary. What they're talking about here would be technical chemicals often, shoe polish, stripping chemicals at a factory used to, like, take paint off of something. So people that are so addicted to alcohol, they're actually drinking non-beverage alcohol. And 8% of the sample in this study, which was based in one kind of standard Russian town, 8% of the men said, yeah, in the past year, I drank this. I think that's probably underreported from talking to some people. You know, when you do these kinds of self-report studies, you often get a low estimate. 10% of the men, at least, again, I think this is probably a low-ball estimate, were involved in something called zapoy, which is two or more straight days of being drunk and neglecting your obligations, neglecting to go to work, neglecting to provide for your family, neglecting to attend to other responsibilities, and just kind of being drunk and out of it. And I was always a little nervous talking about this with the Russians because you didn't want to sound like the American that's come in and stereotyping them. And I said, you know, have you guys heard about this zapoy thing and tell me about this? And they said, oh, yeah, it's a big problem. So it's something that's sort of talked about, and the research is showing it affects a lot of Russian men. So just a little bit of kind of the background there about substance abuse before I kind of talk about what the churches are doing with this. And even before I talk about what the churches are doing, here's what is kind of being done in Russia in general. There's not a lot of information available about the interventions that social service providers are using, but what seems to be the most standard is a one-time meeting with a professional, some sort of a directive consultation where basically it's somebody saying, don't drink. You know, and you know, there's not a lot of kind of depth to this. But a Russian research psychiatrist from Moscow, the Moscow Institute of Psychiatry, I believe, Dr. Nemtsov, wrote an article about this, and he said, you know, in his studies, this is what he's found the most, is this kind of one-time session where people are saying, you need to stop drinking. One thing that was done kind of on the macro level was that in the 80s, Gorbachev actually started an anti-alcohol campaign. And this is sort of interesting. His daughter was a physician, or is a physician. I think she's still with us. And she kind of pushed her dad to do something about the alcohol problem. And what they did is they raised the taxes quite a bit on alcohol. And they started to get an immediate change. Over a few years, the life expectancy rose 3 years in a very short amount of time. And so all of a sudden, people were living longer. But this was hugely unpopular. Russians did not like the idea of being taxed more. Some people kind of told me anecdotally that they knew a lot of people who started drinking more of the non-beverage alcohol at this point. So there was enough change that there was an effect, but then there were also people that were going underground, either brewing their own alcohol or drinking stuff that wasn't supposed to be drank. And so this all kind of died out around the time that the government fell apart and that communism ended and the USSR dissolved. So this campaign was in place for a few years from the mid-80s to either the late 80s or early 90s, but it kind of died out. And Russians don't remember it fondly. The public health people like it, but Russians weren't crazy about it. So one of the things that I found very interesting about being in Russia, and this is where I did some of my research, was on what are Protestant churches doing to deal with the problem of addiction, of substance abuse. And so up in the corner there is a picture of one of the Protestant rehabs in an area where I did my research. This actually wasn't one of the rehabs I got to, but it's similar to some of the ones I got to visit. What I did was I went to three different rehabs and did large group interviews, focus group interviews, we call them, through a translator. So it was very interesting. You know, I kind of came in and people were translating for me. So everything takes twice as long, right? Because I've got to have all my questions translated and then all the answers translated back. So I was always afraid I was the boring American that took up 2 hours of their day, and you know, for what should have been a one-hour conversation. What often happens with these rehab programs is the church will say, we want to start a rehab. And here, you know, we'd have to get state licensing, we'd have to hire professionals, and we'd have to find a facility and get it licensed. In Russia, you pretty much just go out and find a house in the country. And the country in Russia really is the country. When you get outside the cities, it's kind of wide open. So it's just this wide open land, and anybody can kind of go there and do anything. So when you go on a picnic in Russia or a camp out in Russia, you just drive out until you get to a field somewhere that looks good and you sort of go and do whatever you want in it, including starting fires or pitching a tent. And so often these rehabs kind of take place out in the country in a little farming village on the edge of a village where they will, you know, rent a large house. And basically the model is we're going to put 10 to 15 or 20 or more drug-addicted, alcohol-addicted people in this house, and the person leading the program is often going to be somebody that's been sober for a year, maybe 2 years at the best. So not somebody with a lot of experience, usually somebody with no professional training, although they might have had a little bit of Bible school or something. And so what often happens, one of the things that's interesting there is there's often mixed gender participation. Here in America, we really try to avoid this, I think for good reason. There's sort of horror stories about what happens when you have men and women together in rehabs. In Russia, that isn't as much of a taboo, and so that often happens. But so they'll take this group of people, and they'll put them in a house, and surprisingly, they don't seem to talk much about their addiction, about their past. What they do is they have this very structured program of Christian discipleship. And so this would just be sort of a sample day for these folks. They often wake up at 5 in the morning and have a time of prayer. Then they eat breakfast, they clean the house. They often listen to a sermon on either the TV, usually by videotape or by, you know, a DVD. And then they eat lunch, and then they'll pray some more. Sometimes they actually have long periods of fasting, so then they wouldn't eat. But they'll often do that. And they'll often have times of intercessory prayer. And so they'll pray for their leaders. They'll pray for their city. One of the things that's interesting, though, is they don't seem to talk or even pray a lot about their specific addictions. They almost seem to feel as though, from what I could tell, is that that's sort of too selfish, which in some ways kind of fits with what we know about addiction, that addiction is something that kind of turns us inward on ourselves and makes us very self-focused. So they spend a lot of time praying for each other, praying for the city, praying for their leaders, for their church, not a lot of time giving prayer requests for themselves, and not a lot of time doing the sorts of things that I used to do with the clients I worked with, where we're trying to think, what are some triggers? What led you to using drugs and alcohol? What do you need to avoid? Are there some places, are there some things associated with that? Was there some sort of conflict that was unresolved? They really don't do a lot of that looking back. They kind of say, okay, I'm going to be a different person from here on out. To do that, I need to have a strong relationship with Christ. They need to have a strong sense of discipleship. And so we're going to focus on that. So not much in the way of counseling and psychotherapy. The one exception to kind of looking back is they do really value testimonies of people who have gotten clean and sober. So after somebody's been at this rehab for a while, they will often have a chance to kind of share their story. And so that's the one time when kind of the addiction seems to be talked about. But it doesn't seem to necessarily be kind of an everyday part of things. The other thing that's interesting about these programs is they often have two or three phases. The first phase, the people are in the program, and they're doing this kind of structured discipleship program. The second phase often involves living out in an apartment in a city, getting a job, but doing that with another person or two, and sometimes with a leader, with somebody that's been clean longer, for accountability. So it's kind of reintegration into society. And then often the third phase is going back and being what they call a servant or a worker at the rehab. So maybe not a paid worker, but being a volunteer worker, with the idea that you've kind of gotten help, you've gotten out, you've been reintegrated into society, and now you come back and you're somebody that's participating in the life of the community as a leader, but they consider the leaders to be servants. People come back and serve among the population. What's interesting about this is it kind of violates a lot of things that those of us in the profession of social work or in similar allied professions like counseling or psychology, psychiatry, would say, in that, you know, we'd say there needs to be a clear distinction between client and worker. They don't have that. The workers are really former clients, and maybe not that former in terms of time. We'd say that there needs to be kind of a structured focus on the addiction. They often really don't have much of that. It comes up, but it's not something they spend a lot of time on. We'd kind of be worried about people who say that they're cured. You know, the AA, the 12-step model, is that you're in recovering, you're never recovered, that you need to deal with this for the rest of your life. People in Russia will say no. Now, there's some disagreement about this. I heard both sides. But I met some people that said, no, I'm cured. You know, God changed me, and I'm different now. And so, we have to be very careful when we're doing this kind of cross-cultural work, as my co-presenters earlier said, about not kind of imposing our structure on other people. But the anecdotal evidence suggests good outcomes. Now, a lot of these organizations aren't doing kind of outcome studies the way that we would be required to do them here in America, but they can look through their records and they can say, oh, here's this person. He's a...
Thank you for joining us today for NECSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to ethically integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NECSW activities and events, such as NECSW's upcoming Convention 2011 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from October 20th to 23rd, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NECSW members, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the member section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NECSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NECSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening into our podcast session today.